Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York State has rolled out a new program that relies on manufactured homes to tackle housing affordability. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse Taylor reports.
A bright blue home now stands at a once-empty lot in Schenectady's Mount Pleasant neighborhood. It has a stainless steel fridge, three bedrooms, and two baths. But it wasn't built in Schenectady. Instead, it was manufactured at an off-site warehouse and transported to the Electric City. The home is one of three structures that have recently gone up throughout the state as part of a pilot program the governor is calling Move In NY. The program seeks to create 200 modular homes, which can be built more quickly and cheaply than traditional homes, across the state in an effort to address housing affordability. Ruthann Vizunauskas, commissioner of the New York State Homes and Community Renewal Department, says the project alone won't solve the state's affordability crisis. But she says it is an important tool as the state looks to build 800,000 new homes over the next decade as part of a pledge Governor Kathy Hochul made last year.
It could certainly go from 200 to 500 to 1,000 over the years. And I would also say there isn't really, there isn't really one solution to the housing crisis. People need, townhomes and they need single family homes and they need multifamily rentals and large elevator buildings. And so we want to be able to provide in every community all different types of affordable housing. And so this is sort of one piece of the puzzle. And we know we need lots of pieces to make that whole puzzle.
The state agency is now accepting applications from local governments, land banks, nonprofit housing developers, and home manufacturers to build more of these prefabricated homes. Vizunauskas says Homes and Community Renewal is asking each applicant to provide a minimum of 10 locations where a potential new home could be built, and says the program could expand if proven effective. Accepted applicants would be given grants in the form of reimbursements.
We're going to award up to 15, so I would say we'll get maybe between 10 and 15, probably really strong applications, we're hoping.
Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy says the city plans to apply for more housing.
When you do these type of projects, you also see some of the adjacent properties. People pay more attention to detail, fix them up, and it creates a synergy within the neighborhoods that is hard to replicate.
Richard Ruzzo is the deputy chair of the Schenectady County Legislature and is planning to build 10 more of the houses throughout the county. He says people typically cannot receive traditional mortgages for modular homes because of a lack of collateral.
They come and they sit on a frame, and typically what happens is you pull the wheels off, but that frame is still here. And technically, someone could hook a flatbed truck back up to it, put the wheels back on, lower it to the ground, and remove it. So at that point, the collateral would be limited.
Ruzzo says that in this case, the houses have added permanency, making the properties eligible for mortgage applications.
We purchased, we selected these options. He talked about full-size cabinets. He talked about entertainment center, center island, etc. All that was selected at the factory.
The construction and installation of the homes are being supported by $50 million included in the state budget. Three have been built so far. One each in Schenectady, Syracuse, and Newcomb. I'm Jesse Taylor.
New York law, like many states, has a degree of required information to be disclosed by home sellers and allow buyers to get an inspection done on a property they're interested in. What it doesn't do is protect that home buyer from having their effort turned down because they've asked for one. The New York Public News Network's Ryan Zunner reports on the trends that those in the industry are seeing and what legislative actions they're pushing for to ensure safety of homes on the real estate market.
New York state law, like many states, has a degree of required information disclosure from sellers and allows home buyers to get an inspection done on the house they're interested in from a licensed professional. What it doesn't do is protect that home buyer from having their offer turned down because they've asked for one.
The problem is if you don't have access to home inspection, and you're relying on property condition disclosures, you don't have much protection.
That's Larry Ames, secretary and board director of the New York State Association of Home Inspectors. He says their job has been one long trusted by both buyers and realtors for decades. Licensed by the state, they perform top-to-bottom inspections of homes to identify their condition. But with the COVID-19 pandemic came a massive shift in the housing market and its long-established norms.
So our role has not changed. What's changed is the resulting seller's market with a very limited supply of houses created a situation where buyers, home buyers, may have been encouraged or decided to waive a home inspection contingency, which is part of a purchase offer generally, or had been, in order to make their offer more attractive, in addition to maybe offering 20-30% over the asking price and putting in very, very high down payments.
Nearly 25% of buyers waived home inspections in 2024, according to the National Association of Realtors. While putting in offers well above asking price and waiving inspection may get enthusiastic buyers a home, Ames says it can come at a high cost and fights with insurance companies once a buyer moves into a home.
They have to be very careful about the homes that they accept, and they will often send out an inspector of their own to look at the house. I've seen cases where an inspector came out and said, yeah, you need a new roof, a front porch, a new electric service. Well, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars, and the family may be strapped with nobody else to ask for help and no other resources, having paid 20-30% over asking price, put down a large down payment. And what are they going to do?
Without home insurance, a mortgage company can start foreclosure proceedings. That's one of the reasons why Ames and New York's Association of Home Inspectors is pushing for state legislation that strengthens home buyers' rights to an inspection. Massachusetts now has a law, and there is a renewed effort in New York. State Senator Rachel May introduced a bill for the 2025-2026 legislative session that would prohibit both sellers and buyers from agreeing to sell residential properties with the contingent that an inspection be waived or restricted.
I think it's a necessary and obvious step. You know, there are property condition disclosure laws. The legislature has done that to support home buyers, and they've created the home inspection profession to support home buyers in this. They realize that it's important for the buyer to have professional evaluation and to know what they're buying.
May's bill is currently in committee. The legislature reconvenes in January. Ryan Zunner for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. We talked about all things financial, including financial cuts from Washington that he says will hurt New Yorkers.
You know, it's true our statutory reserves are higher than they've ever been, and that's good news. And you know, for years now, you know, as Comptroller, I've been calling for a greater putting aside money in the reserves. But the reserves in and of themselves are not going to be enough to deal with the impact of the cuts. You know, so, you know, particularly on the health care side, the Medicaid program, you know, you're talking about billions of dollars of cuts. And you know, 35-40% of any given year state budget is federal funds. So when the federal funds are being cut, whether that's on healthcare, education, or energy programs, go down the list, it has an impact on the overall state budget. And of course, because much of the state budget, David, as you know, goes to localities, goes to counties, cities, towns,
sure,
villages, school districts. You know, there's a potential for a ripple effect that's very, very concerning. And you know, I'm talking numbers, I'm talking budgets, but what's the human impact? You know, just take the healthcare cuts alone, New York. And you've heard me talk about it on the show before, and you're listening to heard me talk about it. You know, we've done a great job compared to other states of really building on Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, the Essential Plan, the expansion of Medicaid. You know, if we were doing this show with Alan a number of years ago, we were talking about 10% of our population not having health care coverage. Well, now we're down to less than 5% of our population in New York without health care coverage. We're one of the states that have really taken full advantage of the changes. And now with these cuts, it's going to go in the opposite direction. You know, he's basically been gutting the essential plan on the federal subsidies there. The governor has asked for a correction on the waiver to move some of those folks who are going to potentially lose health care coverage. It was estimated to be about 1.5 million New Yorkers, by the way, would lose health care coverage. Move them onto basic Medicaid. That will help some, but it's probably still going to be estimated about 450,000 New Yorkers that have health care coverage today won't have it.
Well, what is that going to mean?
Tom,
you know, I talked to the Republicans and they act as if we're not cutting anything. We're making it right. We're taking away those that are getting it that don't deserve it.
Well, I would beg to differ because, you know, the reality is these are New Yorkers and they're still going to need health care. What it's going to mean is that they're going to show up at the hospital emergency room as their doctor's office. It's still going to cost money for everybody else. And whether you're looking at health care or you look at the nutrition program, SNAP, what we used to call food stamps, the cuts there as well. And it's so important to point out with many of the changes, whether we're talking about the health care changes or anything on the social safety net where they're restructuring this relationship and resulting in less money.
SNAP.
It's not only cuts. It's also new administrative requirements and burdens that are going to cost money to oversee the programs. So it's really a double hit in many cases.
Not to mention,
it's still going to take us time to sort out what the full fiscal impact is going to be, and even more so the human impact.
Yeah, not to mention I've seen a number of stories about the people there. You know, you're talking about people who, you know, don't have a lot, maybe not have a lot of education in some cases, and you're asking them to fill out one piece of paperwork after another. You know, a lot of them give up. They don't even continue to try to apply for it because of the complications involved.
Well, don't you think that's part of the purpose, right? Discourage people. Yeah, whether that's SNAP or unemployment insurance, you know, some of the opportunities for people really to not fall, between the cracks. There's a lot of meanness in this approach. You know, let's also, you know, keep in mind that we have a number of our state agencies that have their employees, their workforce, right, tied to federal funding. So you take an agency like Department of Labor, which at the state level has a big role in administering the unemployment insurance program. They have like over 80% of their positions are funded by federal funds. Office of the Aging, over 60%. Department of Health, 25%. State Education, 42%. So you're talking about potential of state workers providing important services not being funded. Now, here's the question. Will the state be able to pick up the slack and backstop this funding?
I'm guessing no.
Maybe in some cases, but across the board, no. You know, because, you know, I try to point out to people, this is not just a question of cuts. This is a fundamental restructuring of the federal-state relationship. We have moved from being a state that was a net giver to Washington in terms of tax revenues versus what we get back, to getting more money back from Washington. That reversed a trend that had existed for a long time. And I had said a while ago, you know, at some point after the COVID relief money would be spent down, we'd probably go back to maybe being a slight donor state. Well, this is going to accelerate that trend. So I don't see any great advantage to New York, certainly in terms of our finances and certainly in terms of impact on New York's population. Now, local governments also, depending, some of them also get federal funds, right? So that's going to affect some of the local governments as well. And again, are these services going to disappear? I don't know. Maybe some of them will. But for sure, knowing New York, we're going to try to backstop as much as we can. I also have to say this, David. We talk about our audits all the time, right, on your show. There are opportunities for us to spend our money a bit more wisely than we have. Medicaid is a prime example. Very expensive program, very important in terms of health care. But as you know from our audits repeatedly, we find opportunities where, with greater supervision of how the program is administered through the Department of Health, money could be saved without hurting people or denying services. You know, inappropriate billing, people placed on Medicaid that should be on Medicare. You know, I mean, you go down the long list of what our audits often find. If there is any silver lining, and I don't see much of a silver lining, maybe it'll get folks to take a little more seriously the kind of audit recommendations we've made, because we do have to be smarter about how we're spending our money, because we're going to have less of it coming from Washington.
Well, it'd be nice if your audits had any enforcement.
Well, we've talked about that, right?
Yeah.
You know, people say all the time, well, you know, you said X, Y, Z. We don't have enforcement power. I don't know that anybody would ever give it to us, but the recommendations are thoughtful. Our auditors are professional. And, you know, look, I can't say that every agency dismisses them. In fact, some agencies embrace them. We're putting out an audit probably as we're speaking on the Thruway Authority, where
That's
we
right.
had some suggestions, criticism, if you will, about how they were dealing with unpaid tolls. And you know what? They took our we did a follow-up audit. So this is what we do. We can't enforce. We can do a follow-up audit. So in the case of Thruway Authority, we did a follow-up audit. And you know what? They implemented a number of our recommendations, and they're doing a much better job of accurately charging users of the system and collecting unpaid tolls. So our audits can have a positive effect.
That's New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A bipartisan group of New York State legislators are coming together to propose the state's first animal boarding legislation. As the Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine reports, it comes after a suite of animal abuse cases this summer.
Oh, he was crazy. He was a Frenchie. He's what we call him a jester. So, because he just didn't care, always happy, always lovey, always expressive. You know, at nighttime he'd go to bed and he slept under the covers with us. You know, just get the kids up in the morning, you know, all of those kinds of things that we miss immensely.
Katie Levy is one of a number of pet owners who gathered at the Saratoga County Sheriff's Department's headquarters Tuesday for the announcement of proposed legislation that would create the first set of standards in New York for animal boarders. Her 2-year-old French bulldog, Gus, died this summer after being left outside in the heat while under the care of an animal boarding facility in Half Moon. In August, two individuals were charged in connection to a case in which police say more than 50 dogs, a majority of which were puppies, were found in deplorable conditions. Now, Republican State Senator Jim Todisco is proposing legislation that would require boarders to register, pay $150 annually for a license, and be subject to random inspections and safety requirements. Violators could face up to a $1,000 fine and suspension of their license.
Nobody should be fearful of having to give their dog to a boarding facility in New York State to go on vacation, to visit a sick loved one, to have some maintenance take place in their house where they have to board an animal, and not know there are uniform guidelines, regulations, and safety features across the state of New York for every facility they may put their dog in. They should have the good comfort, the feeling that their dog will be treated as safe as they're treated in their home.
A draft of the proposed legislation sets standards at boarding facilities for regulating heat and sound levels, ensuring regular feedings of pets, and adequate sanitation practices. Democratic Assemblyman Angelo Santa Barbara is also sponsoring the legislation.
This bill is not about adding burdens. It's about creating confidence. Confidence for families, confidence for responsible business owners, because there's facilities out there that are doing it the right way. Confidence that tragedies like this can be prevented. We don't want to ever have to hear about headlines like this anymore. Whether we've done this in other areas with child care, elder care, we can do it here.
The owners of a Washington County facility were charged with animal neglect in August after 21 animals under their care were found dead at their facility. Authorities report the animals were left inside a kennel for 11 hours without proper ventilation or water. Cody Shields lost 3 dogs boarded at the facility.
I'm not a politician, I'm not a lawmaker, but to see something get moving this fast, you know, I started creating the Safe Pet Boarding Act as an idea, and I was sending it out to legislators and lawmakers. Next thing I knew, you know, Assemblywoman Kerry Warner, Senator Jim Todisco were saying, hey, we like this. We want to take this. We want to move forward with it. So, I mean, it had no motion, and within a month, you know, see where we're at right now.
Todisco tells WAMC he's also determined to establish a statewide animal abuse registry. Currently, only 26 of New York's 62 counties have such registries, with Saratoga County establishing its own this month. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello Levine.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York State's bell-to-bell cell phone ban is designed to cut down on distractions while encouraging students' critical thinking and improving social skills. Many school communities have already reported positive results, but as the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports, the policy has been something of an adjustment.
Albany City School District Superintendent Joseph Hochreiter says we should remember that smartphones are computers, and that means going without is a huge change.
They store our lives, and we learn some things from our own students. For example, that when students do need to contact home, they really need access to their phones because they may not know their home phone number or their mother's cell phone number or older brother's cell phone number or you name it. We're also a very diverse school district, and we're proud of students from 50 different countries speaking 40 different languages, that sometimes our students themselves are translators between families and school personnel.
While many early reports about the law included as part of the New York State fiscal year 2026 state budget have been positive, families are still adjusting. David Albert, the New York State School Boards Association's chief communications and marketing officer, says he is aware of some concerns raised about parents' ability to contact their children in emergencies as the ban limits direct access.
There are arrangements made in the legislation for parents to be able to contact their students. So that could be through the principal's office, or it could be through an email address or something. So there are circumstances there, but it is obviously not quite the same as having that text message capability. So it'll be interesting to see as the school year moves on how the groups react, how parents in particular react to not having that direct access.
NISBA had been hoping for more flexibility in the law.
In our view, we would have perhaps not mandated a bell-to-bell ban, but maybe allowed the school board to work with the communities to perhaps come up with a different solution where maybe cell phones would be banned during the school day, for example, like classes, but not necessarily for recess periods. But we do understand that there is value, of course, in the bell-to-bell ban, and certainly some districts would have undoubtedly gone in that direction anyway.
Still, the law does allow school districts to shape their own strategies for implementing the ban, and that's meant some districts have been more receptive to technology, such as flip phones, while other districts have a blanket ban that includes so-called compliant devices. Internet-enabled devices are defined in the law as any smartphone, tablet, smartwatch, or other device capable of connecting to the Internet. Companies like U.S. Mobile are aiming to take advantage. Company spokesperson Raphael Marchand says the carrier offers what it touts as an unlimited talk and text distraction-free classroom-safe phone for New York State, a non-data model designed for emergency-only communication without Internet access or social media.
I have a young daughter, and our CEO has. Our CEO kids happens to be in a school that already has smartphone bans. When we saw the news coming from the States, we knew it was the right opportunity for us to offer these flip phones, which essentially provide talk and text. No data, so they are compliant with the law.
But even with such technology on the market, Albert, with the School Boards Association, says he's heard of only a few reported incidents of students trying to circumvent the rules. Meanwhile, proponents of the ban say they are already noticing benefits. Dr. John Cohen is CEO of Talkspace, a New York-based telehealth provider of mental health services that strongly supports the ban. Cohen says social media addiction is a greater threat to teenage health than cigarette smoking.
The average number of hours that a teenager spends on social media is now 8 hours a day. That's eight. And a third of the teenagers are now spending their time on social media essentially all the time. The result of that is significant increase in loneliness, significant increase in low self-esteem, significant increase in happiness. 45% of the teenagers are now reporting higher anxiety as a result of the social media.
Cohen says other risks with cell phones include cyberbullying, predators, inappropriate challenges via apps like TikTok and Snapchat, access to sexual content and pornography, and significant issues related to eating disorders. Cohen says he fields many questions from parents about how to deal with kids and smartphones and the potential impact the devices have on young lives.
One of the greatest important issues is not to have kids or teenagers have their cell phones at night in their bedroom alone. We highly recommend that at that time you could either have the phone charged or removed. The other is to watch and see what the kids are doing, and if there's a change in your child or your teenager's affect, if you notice that they're more depressed, more withdrawn, is to really reach out and get help. And the final is there are some communities right now who are having what's called a pledge. It's called Not Until 8th, meaning there are communities who are getting together and agreeing not to provide cell phones to their kids until they're in eighth grade.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2539. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.